But some students went to see a doctor because they'd been injured in one of these incidents with the Klan elements or whatever, and the doctor called the Klan in, and they got hurt more. And it made the front page of the Times, and I organized the thing. We wrote to the American Medical Association and the State Society, and oh, what an episode.
Do you remember what city that was in?
I don't. It was one of the smaller towns. It wasn't one of the major cities that I remember. Boy, someplace I have that. I don't think it's been sent down. See, I'm still holding on to all my stuff because I'm using some of my earliest stuff. I'm writing about the way children acquire their moral values and their political values, and so I'm going over some of that early stuff with the black and white children and the civil rights people for evidence of, But it was in August of '64, and with a front page. Began on the front page of the New York Times. And what the devil was his name? Was a Polish name. His father was a doctor in Connecticut, Harvard undergraduate, who had been injured by what amounted to a plot between a Mississippi physician and these goddamn hoodlums. They left his office and they beat them up.
I guess a lot of the volunteers have written about their reaction to the Black Hole. It would be hard for me, as would for any of us, to sort of look at the reciprocal reaction of the Black people.
That interested me as much as the whole Mississippi Summer Project. Going into Black Homes for years. I think there was a mixture of awe, admiration, envy, surprise, confusion, and perplexity, annoyance, anger, all the emotions,
right,
depending on which fit, which student, in which home, which level of aspiration for the black families, which willingness to kowtow, which pride, which self-confidence that enabled seeing these people accurately and evaluating them for what they are rather than that whole penumbra, that old mystique, after all, some of them have never had white people so close to them. My wife and I certainly experienced some of those difficulties going into black homes.
Was it more difficult for white women, do you think?
Oh, unquestionably so. My wife and I, as a husband and wife, went to marriage ceremony that was held. The older sister of one of the black kids we had known in Atlanta, and my wife was the center of attention in that entire thing, rather than the couple that were getting married. It was horrible. All the kids who wanted to touch her hair, and oh, I'm ashamed to even talk about it. So, for them, they'd never seen to white people at anything in their lives other than working in their homes and seeing them from that distance. Suddenly we were social equals of sorts, however whether you ever can be in a situation like that. But there, a lot of that was going on. That focus is rural Mississippi. It's hard to even talk about it with any credibility these days. Believe me, it was a very, very powerful issue continually at work, namely these white people staying in these homes, these white people eating with one at the table, these white people supposedly struggling on behalf of matters that you yourself couldn't even picture yourself struggling on behalf of. This is loaded with stuff.
Right.
Now, how the particular white volunteers respond to that, vanity, pretty nice being looked up to as God Almighty. Humility, shame, embarrassment, awkwardness, the whole list.
You have a quotation in one of your articles about, I think it's a Harvard undergrad that talks about how it's viewed as some sort of strange god, both a good one and a bad one. that's a feeling that was...
I think a lot of them felt that. They'd never before been treated quite like that.
Mm-hmm. And that was all over the state, or...?
Well, wherever they were predominantly in the Delta, although some went down to the coast, and some did try that northeastern part of Mississippi, but that was a tough area, as I well remember. Mm-hmm. I mean, the hill part of Mississippi, they by and large stayed out of that. Toughest part of the state, they knew it. See, they knew that the Delta, you know, in Mississippi, the safest parts were the Delta, Jackson, and the Gulf Coast. The parts that traditionally had been most liberal in race in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and the hills out of which came, you know, the whole Bilbo, so-called redneck tradition. I hate to use that word because it's used by a lot of snotty people who are looking down upon whites in Mississippi and don't see their own arrogance as privileged whites in the North and all that. It's too much of a crime. Anyway, the answer is a whole range of emotions.
Okay. Yeah. What about the specific projects that you... as you moved from Freedom House to Freedom House, did you get the sense that there was a plan for each project and people knew what they were doing, or?
I felt that that varied from project to project. Some of them were much better organized than others, and it's the whole story of the chemistry, the individual chemistry of the particular volunteers, and the black leadership in SNCC, which also varied enormously.
Mm-hmm.
I thought actually Canton was one of the better. In large part due, actually, to Paul. He was really, you know, an extremely able volunteer.
He was in Vicksburg for a while, too, I think.
He was in Vicksburg,
yeah,
that's right.
That's right. And he talked about his project leader as being Papa Doc. That's his name for it. I thought that's Moses who that was.
What's the name of the guy who went down to the coast with rather heavy, overweight, that was a minute if you told me. He went to Hattiesburg, and then I think they made forays down to Biloxi Gulfport.
Mm.
I never liked him. Talk about arrogance. You know, arrogance was not only confined to whites.
Mm-hmm.
There was responsive arrogance. Maybe self-initiated arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think that any of these emotions follow a color line necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Did you, this is, I guess, a hard question, did you get the sense in the beginning that, what did you get a sense in the beginning, in the planning stage, what really the goals of the summer?
White presence, political presence, social presence, direct assault on the bastion of segregation, national prominence of the whole issue, tragedy and its triumph.
Mm-hmm. So the specific SIG project...
To dare to show up in Macomb, Mississippi, to dare,
mm-hmm.
to stay there, to last, just to last was a triumph. A couple of weeks in Macomb and not be killed,
mm-hmm.
incredible. It's hard to create that for you now, believe me.
Right.
At that time, Jackson, I mean, it was like the capital of, like Berlin in 1937 or 38. I mean, it's where Hitler lived, and you'd never get there.
Mm-hmm. It's just, the reason I asked it, it's hard to sort through, Moses says success, I have trouble with the word itself, but it's hard to sort through success, because
look, no matter how much trouble he has with the word, and I know what he's talking about morally, spiritually, and in the long run and everything, the fact is that was a success by the criteria that they may have not explicitly spelled out for newspaper reporters or even for one another,
mm-hmm.
but they knew it.
Mm-hmm.
It was successful because the whole country was galvanized around that state. The heat was generated. The governor himself squirmed.
Mm-hmm.
The president pushed through a civil rights bill. I mean, that was a success.
Mm-hmm.
By their fondest dreams a year earlier, and I remember them dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you get to that, of course you say, if you're like Bob Moses, oh, but look, Yeah. What did we really accomplish?
Right.
So let me be the cynic to say they accomplished plenty.
Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, though, the challenge becomes important then in the various Atlantic City challenge becomes important in the various mind states. Because it seemed that I'm sitting in a congressional office with Barney Frank, and he said to me, the Atlantic City challenge, the offer of two seats was a major American political victory. And I don't think Bob Moses is going to tell me that.
No, of course not.
And so, to me and you, there's the success there, but how, in other words, when they started the summer, was the Atlantic City obviously was on their minds, but
I didn't think Atlantic City was a major thing.
No.
I think the major thing, the fact that Atlantic City came on their mind was a measure of the success.
Okay.
So, you have to have a chronological, psychological sense of this. A year before, they weren't thinking of Atlantic City. People like you and I might think of elections here. So,
right.
At that time, they were thinking of would they survive and get through and even be able to launch a summer project without all of them being shot down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's where their trajectory was, not you and Humphrey in Atlantic City.
Okay.
But when you become as prominent as they became, and when you become centers of national attention and the whole country's going through the kind of tremendous changes and the president's been killed and suddenly legislation is possible, then you start thinking of Atlantic City.
Mm-hmm.
After all, one of the reasons they were thinking of Atlantic City is how these white politically minded people have become their buddies who were thinking of Atlantic City,
right.
Like the Cowans and all the other people who were part of that. The American mainstream thinks that way.
Mm-hmm.
So they had become moved into something that they themselves, I don't mean, I'm sounding like an awful snob saying these things, but this would be, in retrospect, and even, not even in retrospect, the way I think some people would have felt right at the time as to what was happening. There were reporters all over the place. They were being quoted left and right. Who's used to that? You and I aren't used to it ordinarily in our everyday lives.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly they were becoming, what is the word, figures,
mm-hmm.
including political figures. So indeed they thought of Atlantic City, and also they were being objects of manipulation by various parts of the Democratic Party, because now they were a constituency of sorts,
mm-hmm.
a moral, political, and social constituency within a particular party.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are people all over all the wonderful suburbs of Cleveland and Boston and New York who read about all this in the New York Times, seen the bereaved parents going into the White House and being embraced by the President of the United States, who were very concerned about these people, knew about them. But this did not happen, what is happening when?
Okay. For you, so how long were you then in the state?
I had to stay right through this summer. And I came back, I flew back a couple of times after my son was born.
Mm-hmm.
And then got into another thing which I have time if you're interested, which is a year later, the so-called child development group in Mississippi struggle with OEO, and there's a whole book about that called The Devil Has Slippery Shoes, which I think I told, did I tell you about that?
Mm-hmm.
Written by Polly Greenberg and another.
Okay, that brings up another question I wanted to ask you. Did you sit in on any of the freedom schools?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They vary in
the very
effectiveness. Some of them are very good and some of them are absolutely terrible.
Is that people?
People.
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 Mm-hmm.
Always. What else is a school of people? You know.
Right.
You've been to enough of them, you know that a teacher can make or break any subject.
Mm-hmm. How are the successful teachers successful?
Well, I felt that some of the most successful teachers were the teachers you probably have to correct for my prejudices and romanticism. I thought they were some of the quiet people in the Midwest who were most talkative and for themselves, but were very devoted to the kids, were in contrast to some of the hot shots. But you cannot make a total case of either. Any generalization has to be qualified.
Right.
Hasten to qualify the generalization I just made.
Mm-hmm.
but there were individual efforts of children, health education, political education, literacy, that were very good and an important beginning of something. Mm-hmm. And that still lives on. Have you ever been to Mississippi, by the way?
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to go. I'll send you to people if you want, but I mean, that's an important experience. Not as you're working, as you should go. We are in Alabama.
The northern part of the state, just sort of
driving through. You should go and stop. Let me, I can give you all kinds of contacts, but I mean, it's an interesting state.
Mm-hmm. So I contemplated going down there and writing for half a year.
Didn't you?
Yeah.
After?
For, you know, for newspapers. Stopping there.
Well, let me know. I might be able to help you get a job in some of those southern newspapers. I've done that before. Depending on where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good idea.
I guess if you could, we can one more question is, I guess to sort of, I don't even know how to ask these questions about Bob Moses, but I got the sense in the training sessions and in the summer that he was brokering a lot of these tensions. Is that an accurate feeling?
Well, that's a powerful verb.
Yeah.
It has all kinds of implications to it, which I do not think one should shirk. In other words, I think he was. Have you ever read Eric Erickson's book on Gandhi?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Erickson was very intrigued with Bob Moses. I don't know whether Bob Moses knows this or not. Once Bob Moses spoke, once I spoke about Bob Moses, and Erickson came to hear it because he was very intrigued with him and hearing things about him I don't think he ever knew.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, Erickson was interested in Gandhi and in these religious figures, religious-political figures. Christ himself tells us that one uses that serpents and doves imagery, and I think that would apply to Bob, along with all the rest of us, maybe. He was brokering. He was very shrewd and very politically savvy. He was also sweet and innocent and lovely. He was calculating, and he was kind. He was knowing, and again, innocent. I mean, this is what I mean. Novelists do a much better job of evoking this than these categorical social scientists who are always trying to label people and call them reductively this or that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he definitely brokered. He was a figure who could somehow bring together people and work with them and disarm the usual hostilities and self-centered envies and rivalries that all people have. There was also a certain charismatic quality about him, but it's an interesting kind. It's low-key. The eyes, a lot of people focus on the greenish eyes, which are a little, you know.
Right.
There's an unusual stare, which I think you'll still see, but you have to correct the fact, of course, he's older now. There was a youthful, almost cat-like tension in him, bound-up energy that never really, I mean, with Stokely, it got expressed in those increasingly well-known rhetorical postures, and Jim Foreman, those little craziness. He's been in a mental hospital.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's never been. He's had a psychiatric history before. Bob was an exceptionally intriguing and attractive and somewhat mysterious figure. His silences were extremely powerful. His eyes were extremely commanding as well as watchful. He was very shrewd. I'm using the word with all the risks involved.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a leader. and he had imagination and moral intelligence, as well as some plain old everyday intelligence. He was able to work with a range of people, from self-important intellectuals to ordinary people in neighborhoods. He was very patient and he was brave.
There's a, in one of the letters, one of the volunteers wrote, he seems to have the moral perplexity about him and only characters in novels.
Yeah, well, that's true. Mm-hmm. And he never got taken up with his own self-importance or even the self-importance that a project can generate. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the very part that has already had him saying what does success mean was with him even as he was determined. And that combination of being a capacity for reflection and distancing from the thing that you're very much in the midst of and even leading, this is a very rare quality. Mm-hmm. He never got carried away with this and yet managed, yet that did not undermine his everyday enthusiasm and initiative, because you can imagine someone with this kind of distance and historical and moral complexity to him being unnerved and undermined, the momentum being undercut by these qualities. But somehow he both persisted vigorously in the everyday requirements of an essentially political and social kind of entrepreneurship, again, risks with that word, and yet maintain almost a Tolstoyan sense of history about all this. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think some of the people found amazing. Very rare quality. All you had to do is compare him to some of the other people in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, I think, I know the word charisma is much overused,
yeah.
But he had a moral charisma, and he had a he's a very reflective person, as you'll see. But no fool, and very precise, and very shrewd, very savvy and sophisticated, with all the risks of those words.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in one of your articles about the, well, you said it, the guilt feeling about as much as do you think there was guilt after the murders?
And him?
Was he able to abstract it out, or do you think?
Guilt, you gotta be real careful. Guilt is when you've done something wrong. I don't think he ever felt he did anything wrong. I think sadness as a human being, sadness that this happened, horror,
mm-hmm.
and sadness, not guilt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he at any point felt personally responsible for this. Sure, they organized the Mississippi Sound Project. Sure, they knew in their heart of hearts that these kinds of incidents probably in the long run was going to help it, although I'm not sure they could sit and formulate it that clearly for themselves and unspokenly. But I think that guilt was not one of the major, no. I think they were, the disgust and the horror and the anger and not guilt. Guilt is the kind of emotion that a lot of us comfortable middle class people like to think is so important in others. They tell me the course I teach the students at times, say they call it Guilt 33, we read A.G. and Orwell,
mm-hmm.
and these writers and Ellison and Percy, and they say, well, this makes us feel guilty, and I try to tell the students, I think you're using this word incorrectly. To be morally upset and outraged is not to feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you've been told that that's what it is means that you are in a way succumbing to a kind of psychiatric ideology that is distancing you from the older, more moral and philosophical traditions and tells you that everything is psychiatric.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more room for plain old moral outrage. It has to be called guilt.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more room for a sense of horror and shame about what's going on in the world. It's called guilt, and the implication is what you should do is go to see a psychiatrist rather than take up action against what you find unjust.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, a very interesting development.
I guess in I know how my friends disarm me sometimes when I'm upset about things. You know, instead of feeling, well, you're guilty, you know.
And you have a problem and going to see a doctor.
Don't be upset about it.
Yeah. Because if you're upset about something, what that means.
Yeah. Another question I had is, what did you have a sense of the parents of the volunteer? Were a lot of the kids going against the
will? That's a very important subject. A lot of these kids, their parents were frightened out of their minds. I always tell the story of this girl whose father was a psychoanalyst in Chicago.
Who is this?
I forgot her name, but she was depressed, and actually some of the people at SNCC, Bob or Jim, one of them said, you better go and talk to her. We've heard she's quite depressed. So I went over to the dorms there in that Western College for Women, and I looked her up and talked to her for a while. And she didn't seem too depressed to me. She said, the only problem I have is my parents are calling me all the time. So I said, well, would you want me to call them? So she said, would you? So I said, I did. I did call them. And the father got on the phone and he told me that he's very worried about his daughter. And he wanted me to know that when she was 12, she had a depressive episode. I said, oh, now she's 20. So I said, well, gee, I just talked to her. She seemed fine. So he said, well, she did have this episode. So I thought, I said, so did I. So did everyone. Who knows? But then the mother was listening on an extension, and she said, you know, doctor, it's my husband who's depressed now. He's very worried about me. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, the worry is not depression. Worry is worry. Mm-hmm. And you have every reason to be worried. I can't tell you not to worry. You should worry. So should we all.
Is sexual fear part of that?
On the part of the parents? I think they're afraid they'd get killed, but I think some of them would not care or acknowledge if we could have, including me. And I had a daughter down there. The sexual issue has not been much talked about. I think if you know the South, would prove to be exaggerated. But they should be acknowledged as there. They were wrong to be so frightened.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, everyone had been caught up in the old stereotypes.
Right.
But they were caught up in the stereotypes, and I would imagine more than any of us wanted to ever talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Those women went, didn't they?
Did you think any of them got caught up in the stereotype in there, in their mind?
I think some of them were, and some of them handled it, as you often do, by becoming anonymous, confirming the stereotype by flirting with blacks. So great was their anxiety. You can get into a whole psychiatric spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Others maintained a quiet dignity, and there were a whole range of involvements, emotional, sexual, social, between white women and black men. But then you'd have to say, white women and white men too.
Mm-hmm.
So you always hold on to that particularity,
mm-hmm,
in people as you think about the fraction number 780. But you know,
yeah.
The AG, what he writes about is not the most famous men. Do you know that book?
Mm-hmm.
Each person is different. And that was very apparent as you went from Freedom House to Freedom House. The tone varied. And with some of the social and economic and personal backgrounds, as they amounted ultimately to a particular collectivity. After all, what are we talking about? About 5 or 10 people in each of these freedom,
mm-hmm,
houses, or 15 at the most. 20, kind of, I don't know, 20.
Well, this has been enormously helpful.
Oh, well.
But thank you.
Well, I blabber on and on, but you've got an interesting subject. Has Bill helped you to get in touch with people or all the various? I presume you know Larry Goodwin.
Right. Well, he's...
Well, I thought the discussion was had a lot of negative. Well, because the emotional pitch was so high, and you couldn't get into what the real practical issues were, but more around are you violent or non-violent? Or even if you're not, are you violent? Because no one's going to say they're violent. Or are you non-violent? And people don't want to say they're non-violent. So I'm not sure. I mean, the interaction with the volunteers was too short, and what they would pick up certainly would be much more what the person, the staff person on the project they were on, or the people they were living with, what their attitudes would be. And certainly, we didn't meet any people in Mississippi who were practicing nonviolence. None of the people we were working with were. And while they sometimes, you know, acknowledge that we ourselves were practicing nonviolence, so said, they were not buying it. And we weren't selling it. That's the other thing. There was nothing in the work that we were doing which required that any of the people we were working with practiced nonviolence. There's nothing in terms of going down to register or anything like that which required that they take a nonviolence stance. Right? We weren't putting that. It may have been something that we were requiring of ourselves, but it wasn't something that was like the sit-ins, right, where you're anticipating that there's going to be some violence directed at the people who are participating personally, and therefore they should be trained. So the whole, see, Lawson was at Oxford, because Lawson's particular approach and commitment to nonviolence died in Mississippi in the movement, actually long before the Summer of Project. I think it died right after the Freedom Rides in the summer of 61, when a lot of the people that he had trained gathered in Jackson and tried to launch a nonviolent movement and failed. He himself, for whatever reason, didn't feel that he should join the movement in its organized form. And so he wasn't there. And there wasn't the spiritual engine that you need to make something like that go. Also wasn't there. And so it died. I remarked on its death at the time, something that I was watching very closely. And so you were left with this more practical program of voter registration and organizing, which didn't require either on the part of the staff or the people,
right,
a commitment to nonviolence. Nothing in the federal government says you must be nonviolent to
right.
register.
Right.
And they encourage everyone to register. Everyone has the right to register. It's part of the law. So there's nothing in the law saying that you have to adopt this or that kind of stance. So, the volunteers, as far as I can see, didn't get a heavy dose about nonviolence. And certainly they were not, most of them, coming from some kind of nonviolent stance or background. unless there was some Quakers.
Was there, in terms of the composition of the volunteers, what sense was there that they were recruited not only for who they were, but the connections that they had?
No sense. I mean, the people at Stanford and Yale, the assumption is in the society that, you know, those students are well connected. But aside from the fact that college students in the society as a whole are well connected, I don't have any recollection of people being concerned, you know, prestigious connections.
Well, the reason I ask that is because I read an interview report of Jeffrey Cowan.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that might have been...
Because who would have known about that? I mean, the people who might have known about... There was a group of people who were might have known and interested in that. Do you remember or run across the name Tim Jenkins?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well...
He was Nashville?
No, Tim was at Yale Law School.
Oh.
And was a vice president of NSA.
Oh, right, okay.
And he was black. And
very influential. Yeah. Oh, you want? Okay.
At the time of the summer project, I guess he was still a student at Yale, just getting ready to graduate. And so was Eleanor Holmes. And there was a group of people like that who were high-powered in themselves in prestigious organizations or schools, who might be aware of this or that person, you know, and their connection.
It's certainly not the staff people in Mississippi.
Staff people in Mississippi, sure. And couldn't care less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to just be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want them down there.
Mm-hmm.
Much less some guy who might someday pop up at a meeting, you know, flash his connection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just served to remind them of you know, everything that they were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you get somebody like Gia among the staff. My voice. Some sentiments in that area that about people with connections and what's happening. But then Gia was involved in it, including.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a difference between the people who were doing the voter registration, the volunteers, the voter registration work, and those who came to the Freedom School orientation?
Oh, I have no way of knowing. It doesn't seem like they could be. I guess as the applications came in, people indicated their interest. There were some social scientists from Michigan. I think they were from Michigan. Came down to the orientation. They wanted to study
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think. And they didn't let them. So the chance for all those, all that kind of analysis went by the boards, and we weren't equipped to do it ourselves.
I guess I'm trying to draw a distinction between some of the quieter, from what I can sense, some of the quieter Southern students came from, let's say, whose motivations, if you can be rude enough to be a social scientist, would be, let's say, more, let's say, religiously motivated, as opposed to some of the northern volunteers. Did you sense there was at all a sort of class division among the volunteers?
The division along regional lines between Southern students?
Well,
were there, I mean, do you have figures on the numbers of Southern?
Most of them were, I think it's somewhere. I could look up, but somewhere around 80% from the north. But what I'm getting at is.
And how many of those from the south were black?
Well, that's the thing something like 90% of the ones from the south were black. So, when I talked to Sue Thrasher down at Highlander. She had more or less come right out of the Nashville movement. And, in other words, the volunteers that are traditionally written about, especially in the media, are the sons and daughters, the people with connections, the people very verbal, the people talking to reporters. And yet, you get this undercurrent of feeling that there was another whole group there that...
there was quite a group of people there. And I suppose in their own right, they deserve to be studied. It might, just to get some understanding about America, and I suppose if the funds were made available, it's possible to do it, to actually go out and study. Wally Roberts, who was at Freedom School, wanting to show him everything.
He was master's citizen advocate now? Or?
Right, fish, yeah. He's right up here.
Do you know if he's still living in Boston?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I have a phone.
Oh, really? Okay.
And there's another girl who is with the Freedom School who is heading up the School for Organizers in Chicago. So I don't know that it's true or not, but I have the sense that a lot of them, a lot of the volunteers, have made their own in the society as a whole, among them, and now they made some kind of mark on it. And experience in Mississippi was important.
There's a book being written on this, actually.
Oh, really?
A guy named David Chalmers in Florida. I don't know how he's doing it, per se. There's five books being written, as far as I can feel out. Which is quite interesting in itself. Right now, why is this? It's interesting to me since I'm writing it myself. But,
but I have no idea about that question. I mean, except I did buy the image of the volunteers as the well-connected.
You said you didn't buy that?
No. I mean, that was not, I never thought of that as more than something else than Evans and Novak, you know, and their theory that this great plot, you know. So, and of course, Al thought more along those lines of connections and political connections, and operated with connections. But we weren't operating that way. I mean, our few little connections were with the Justice Department, Burke Marshall, but really John Doerr, who was down in Mississippi.
At the first training session when Doerr spoke, he, from what I can tell, he upset a lot of people. The second training session, I don't know where I read it, but someone said that you actually asked people not to
spend their time arguing.
Right. Why was that?
I guess basically because we didn't do that. I mean, that wasn't how we worked with them, used that. We left that to Atlanta and the publicity machine.